Hello and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. I don't like Jason Turbo. Like Jeff Katz and Dan Epstein, he makes me feel old. It used to be that baseball nostalgia was reserved for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the Boys of Summer, and the New York Yankees of Mantle, Maris, Ford, and Barra. But thanks to these guys, nostalgia now seems to be entrenched in the 1970s. I'm not ready for that yet. I still feel like a 20-year-old trapped in a body. Epstein and Katz have written some great books about baseball in the 1970s and 80s, and now Turbo has added to that subgenre with Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie, Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley Swingin' A's. And in case you're too young to have seen them play, you should know that the A's won 5 consecutive AL West crowns and 3 World Series in a row, beating the Reds in 72, the Mets in 73, and the Dodgers in 74. A dynasty indeed. And all under the colorful ownership of Charles O. Finley, who could best be described as a cross between Bill Veeck for his innovations, including brightly colored uniforms and mustachioed players, and George Steinbrenner for his ego, bluster, and micromanagement. I spoke with Turbo about Finley in those A's and the fun and challenges he had putting the book together. Oh, and that part about hating those guys? I'm just kidding. Guess I'm just cranky. Time for a nap. Jason Turbo, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Hello, Ron. Thank you for having me.
So I got to say that this type of book that's being produced lately by you and Dan Epstein and Jeff Katz about baseball during the 70s and 80s, that's making me feel old. And I'll tell you, nostalgia used to be about the Boys of Summer, you know, the Dodgers of the 50s. But now it's creeping closer and closer, and I don't like it. But congratulations, it's a very interesting book. It brought back a lot of memories of my youth, because I was young at that point. So tell us about the genesis of this book.
I got to say, the staples of classic rock radio are the hits of my teenage years now. So that's making me feel old. Yeah. The genesis of the book really came about when I was in Cooperstown a few years back doing research for an unrelated project and walking through the abundance of memorabilia shops that line Main Street. I found that I was surrounded by Yankees and Dodgers and Red Sox and Cubs, but it was really a struggle to even recognize that this A's team, they're the only team in the history of baseball outside of the New York Yankees to win 3 straight championships, even existed. And it occurred to me that it was a wildly undersold story, an undertold story. And the more I dug into it, the more it became clear that the day-to-day drama of this team, the abundance of clubhouse fistfights and antipathy between the players and the owner and between the owner and the rest of baseball, would have made for very compelling drama, even if it had been a last-place club.
Now, you say that. Are you a fan of this team in particular? Are you a fan of the A's?
No, I mean, I like the A's well enough. I grew up in the Bay Area, but I grew up a Giants fan. Mm-hmm. So the A's were kind of always on the periphery. This wasn't a labor of love. This was a labor of journalism. Yeah, no, it was incredibly fun to write. And I grew to really appreciate all the characters involved, and I now have a deep-seated sense of appreciation for the team. But yeah, I'm not a lifelong A's fan.
Now, one of the things that resonated with me as a Mets fan is it made me think back to the 1973 World Series. Now, can you tell us who Mike Andrews was and why he's so important?
Yeah, this is the cornerstone of the book, in my opinion. Andrews was a second baseman. Kind of, Dick Williams was the manager of the A's for the first 2 championships. He was Dick Williams' kind of guy. He was gritty. He was a hard-nosed player, and he was kind of all-star caliber when he played for Dick Williams back in Boston several years earlier. By the time he came to the A's, they signed him as a free agent. He had been waived by the White Sox mid-season 1973. He was pretty broken down. He had a shoulder injury. He was no longer a capable fielder. Williams knew this. He urged Charlie Finley, the team's owner, to sign Andrews strictly as a right-handed pinch hitter for bench depth. And that's how they used him the whole second half of the season. He made a couple of starts. They went at second base. They went very poorly. He never saw the field again up until game two of the 1973 World Series. For some inexplicable reason, in extra innings against the Mets, Andrews was inserted at second base, and he made a couple of costly errors, and the A's went on to lose the game. This drove Charlie Finley a little bit batty. He sat in his box scheming of ways to replace Andrews on the roster with minor league second baseman Manny Trio. As you know, once postseason rosters are locked prior to the series, they can't be changed except in the event of injury. Yeah. So Finley concocted this situation wherein the team doctor went down to the clubhouse, gave Andrews a very cursory examination, poked him and prodded him for a little bit. They drafted a memo based on the doctor's notes saying, in my opinion, Mike Andrews is too injured to continue playing in the World Series. Not that he got injured during the game, but that he is too injured. And Finley tried to get Andrews to sign it so he could claim Andrews was injured and get Trio onto the roster. Andrews didn't know what to make of it. He spent an hour in Dick Williams' office with Finley, and Williams was there, and one of Finley's assistants was there. The rest of the team was on the bus, ready to go to the airport on a plane bound for New York. They couldn't figure out why the bus wasn't leaving. They knew that Andrews wasn't there. They knew something weird was going on because they had seen the examination. And they actually got so agitated, they worked themselves up into a chant of, "We want Mike! We want Mike!" Mike never showed up. Finley finally won. He browbeat Andrews into signing this contract, you know, under the auspices of, "Aren't you a team guy? Don't you want what's best for the team? Manny Trio can help us more than you can help us." Finally, Andrews caved very reluctantly and ended up going home to Massachusetts instead of joining the team for their games 3, 4, and 5 in New York.
And that created a wellspring of sympathy, not just from the A's, as you say, but even from Mets fans once they got to New York.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, the A's landed in New York, the media capital of the world, and showed up for the workout day. That next day, as a Monday, they taped Andrews' number 17 to their sleeves in athletic tape. The reporters started asking any and everybody at the ballpark, at the hotel, wherever they could find them, what was going on, and the A's unloaded. And they could not tolerate the idea that this had happened. And they all came to the understanding that if Finley could fire Mike Andrews for making errors, he could fire any of them for making errors. And they flat out revolted. Commissioner Bowie Kuhn did his own little brand of revolution. He ordered Finley to reinstate Mike Andrews. Andrews came back to the team, was in uniform for Game 4. Finley instructed Dick Williams, "Do not let this guy see the field," under pain of very serious consequences. Williams' response was, of course, to send up Mike Andrews as a pinch hitter at his earliest opportunity. And as you mentioned, the fans at Shea Stadium, God bless them, gave Andrews a standing ovation. They knew exactly what was going on, and they didn't like the owner any more than anybody else. So they made their stand by applauding the visiting player during the World Series. And the upshot of it was that Williams was sent over the edge by having to take part in this kind of charade. After Game 7, after the A's won, in the victorious clubhouse, literally a champagne was flying all around him, Williams quit. He couldn't take any more, and the Andrews situation was what drove him to it.
Now, you mentioned Bowie Kuhn before. There was no love lost between Kuhn and Finley, was there?
No. I mean, it's hard to say who hated the other guy more. Finley was a guy who thrived on getting his way. The A's were good because Finley called the shots. He was an excellent autocrat, but he struggled when other people tried to step in with outside opinions. And he did not do well with authority figures.
He did very well. Did he also serve as general manager of the team, or was he just the owner?
No, he was general manager. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was an egomaniac. He had a nearly complete inability to delegate authority. And early on, he couldn't stand the thought that some of his employees were calling shots about his baseball team. So he within a few years, he dispensed entirely with the idea of having a GM. He did it himself. He did it in a very interesting way. He wasn't a baseball guy, really, beyond just being a fan. He didn't know how to evaluate talent. But he had a silver tongue. The guy made millions as an insurance salesman. He knew how to sweet talk anybody into whatever he wanted. So he would spend hours on the phone every day, literally hours, calling scouts and executives and fellow general managers in the guise of trade talks. And he would gather opinions about his own players and about players around the league, and he would take detailed notes. And when he heard something often enough, he would act on it. And because he was Charlie Finley, he was a man of perpetual action. In 1972, the A's made, I believe it was 64 or 65 trades during the course of the season, to the point where Dick Williams actually admitted his best method for knowing who was on the roster at any given moment was to go to the ballpark and see who walked in the door. and Finley's genius behind it all was that he left the core guys alone. He never traded Reggie Jackson or Sal Bando or Catfish Hunter or Joe Rudy or any of the guys who really made a difference to the team. These were all bit players who, you know, there were many bad trades in there, but it never really mattered because they'd win with those guys or without those guys.
Now, Finley was a bit of a... He was a maverick, for lack of a better word, when he bought the A's in, was it 1960?
Yeah, he took over in 61.
And then he was the one who starts with the innovations of the colorful uniforms and the white shoes and experimenting with the ball itself. How would you compare him? Who would you compare him closer to? Would you compare him with Bill Veeck or George Steinbrenner?
That's a really tough call. He's kind of the perfect bridge between the two of them. Early on, it was Veeck, no question. I mean, his showmanship could not be stifled. He did have, you know, the colorful uniforms. He dressed his team in white cleats that he forever insisted were made from albino kangaroos. But when he took over the Kansas City Athletics, you know, he built a petting zoo in the outfield. There was, you know, a slope of grass beyond the right field fence. He plopped down a herd of sheep out there that he dyed green, and he had a guy dressed as a biblical shepherd with a big staff who would ring a bell after home runs. He painted the ballpark in vivid colors, and he installed lights in the dugout so that fans at night could look in better. He really had this idea that he wanted to make the game better, and all these ideas would attract fans. And the problem was they never attracted fans. The A's finished no higher than eighth out of 10 American League teams the whole time they were in Kansas City, and they finished dead last four times. So eventually that showmanship gene kind of played itself out, and as Finley's relationship with his players grew increasingly antagonistic, culminating in that 1973 World Series, it dried up entirely. Finley was a guy who wore a zillion hats, most prominent among them being general manager, but he did many other things around the team as well. He had had a heart attack prior to that 73 World Series, which slowed him down somewhat. And when Finley slowed down, the whole organization slowed to a crawl because it all ran through him. Mm-hmm. So he kind of gave up the ghost in the Bill Veeck vein along about 73 or shortly before that. And after that, it became much more like George Steinbrenner. It's an interesting comparison because, you know, the end of this team was the arbitration and free agency era, and it ended because Finley would not play that game. But at the same time, across the country, Steinbrenner was coming onto the scene with a very big splash and winning championships with Charlie Finley's two best players, Reggie Jackson and Catfish Hunter.
Now, you spoke before about the fact that Finley had a silver tongue. He used that silver tongue to charm some of those players, like a Catfish Hunter, like a Vita Blue, into joining his team. And he tried all sorts of shenanigans with them, didn't he?
With Catfish Hunter, it was the days before the amateur draft. So the owner that made the best impression, frequently, you know, by presenting the largest check, but in other ways as well, would get his man. I mean, he showed up in Macon, Georgia for Blue Moon Odom with a cargo truck full of fresh produce, and he helped Odom's mother make a giant dinner for the entire neighborhood. In North Carolina, he showed up at Catfish Hunter's family farm. You know, at the time, he was a 17-year-old named Jim Hunter, and wooed the guy's parents. He brought, you know, green jackets and green bats and orange baseballs that he passed out to all the kids in the area. And he made a very positive impression. This wasn't some scout who was authorized to cut a check on behalf of the A's or whatever team. This was the owner showing up. And he got his guy that way really far more frequently than he maybe should have.
It almost makes me think there was a movie recently about Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's. I'm waiting for a biopic on Charles Finley.
Yeah, I mean the guy is fascinating. He really is. It's easy to paint him as a despot, and he had, many despotic turns, but he also had a significant upside. Like he was a good guy in many ways, and I think that's what makes him so complex. And his complexity is what makes him so interesting.
I want to turn back the clock a little bit. Before I do, I just want to mention that you mentioned that Mike Andrews played under Dick Williams for the Red Sox in '67. Well, this is the 50th anniversary of that season, so another old man reference. But your previous book was The Baseball Codes, about the unwritten rules of the game, and I'm just curious as to the difference in working on that book and working on this one.
Oh, then that one was almost an open-ended topic. That one was 5 years of hanging around ballparks and talking to whoever would talk to me about this code and the stories that it brought up for them and experiences in their own careers, with really no end to it. Like I could have kept researching that book indefinitely because there's always more people to talk to, and I continue to blog on it because there's always more stories that come up every day. With this team, I mean, it's really a very contained cast of characters talking about a very specific slice of history that happened 40 years ago, and hearing these stories from so many different perspectives, and reliving those days that for almost all of them were really the highlight of their career was transformative. I mean, the baseball codes helped me understand the function of baseball, and this book helped me understand the history of baseball.
And again, the Baseball Codes was published by Pantheon Books, this one by Houghton Mifflin. What did you find? Did you find much of a difference in working with the two publishers?
No. For the most part, the editors gave me very, very free rein, and their main function was to help me rein in what tended to be unwieldy manuscripts. The words themselves weren't changed so much as they helped me figure out what to cut when I tended to run long. Mm-hmm. This most recent book, I turned in a manuscript of 310,000 words. Suffice it to say, my editor wasn't thrilled with the idea of publishing a 950-page book. So she did very, very excellent due diligence in helping me figure out how to cut it and how to kind of rearrange what was left over so it would make the most sense.
And we have been talking with the author of that book, Jason Turbo. The book is Dynastic, Bombastic, and Fantastic, Reggie, Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley Swingin' A's. Jason, thanks for talking with us today.
Great. Thank you for having me on, Ron.
And that was our conversation with Jason Turbo. Our next scheduled guest is going to be Gary Siridkowski, author of The League of Outsider Baseball, An Illustrated History of Forgotten Heroes. And we're going to try and do something a little different with Gary. Since he is a graphic artist, I thought I might try to do a Skype interview, a video interview, and we'll see how that comes out. In the meantime, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on your favorite sport, please visit Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com. And finally, a little bit of shameless self-promotion. I just wanted to let you know that my new book, Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War, is available. It came out on April 25th. And I will be appearing at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in Manhattan on Wednesday, May 3rd. For more information, please visit Bergino.com. So long, everybody.
Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a